Take a network break. Grab a virtual donut and join us for our weekly review of tech news. We've got stories on Facebook, Cisco, Intel, a DDoS attack, plus various bits of punditry and speculation. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and we've got the full court packet pushers press today with Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks. Before we jump into the news, thanks to our sponsor, Viptela. You can join the packet pushers in New York City on Monday, October 24th at the Loft Flatiron for a live event sponsored by Viptela. To find out how SD-WAN enables cloud transformation, go to viptela.com for details and to register. Also, thanks to ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from your data center to the cloud. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of your network issues wherever they occur, and then share your insights with your vendors and customers. Sign up for an account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers to monitor 3 locations for free and choose a ThousandEyes t-shirt. Okay, jumping into the news, Facebook has announced the Wedge 100. It's a second-generation top-of-rack switch being released under the auspices of the Open Compute Project. Greg, you had some thoughts about this.
Yeah, I still think the greatest name for a switch ever is Wedge. You've just got to think, like, what is it that, you know, like, is it a wedge between us and the vendors? Is it a wedge between the market? Like, you ever thought about that? I have.
See, I took it as a culinary thing, you know, like, yeah, a lettuce wedge, which is typically served with bacon and ranch or blue cheese dressing, both of which are amazing. So obviously that's the direction they were going in. It's that awesome of a switch.
It's okay. Well, it is pretty amazing. This is a 100 gig switch, right? So we've talked earlier about Facebook wedge platforms, and Facebook is iterating this. Of course, it's got its own FBOSS, which is its own operating system, and it's iterating that as well. So I think there's a few things about this. One is, this is the existing Tomahawk chipset. It's not the new Tomahawk 2 chipset that we talked about. That is, this does 32 by 100 gigabit ports. It uses the Broadcom Tomahawk, so that's the existing one. It's not the next generation Tomahawk 2, which was announced a couple of weeks ago. That chip still won't ship until mid-2017 sort of thing. So we know that, and that one's got 128 100 gig ports in it. So imagine what that will look like. Although I'm not so sure how many, if you can actually fit like a 100 gig port, that many 100 gig ports in one IU, you might see a 2 IU or some very odd. There's going to be some odd combinations of that switch coming out, I suspect. Facebook has only tested it for 25, 40, and 100 gig. So they haven't tested it for 10 gig, which I think is very interesting. It gives you some insight in that Facebook's server rooms or data centers aren't using 10 gig at all. They've just gone straight past to 25 gig NICs everywhere and 100 gig in the backplane, and maybe some 40 gig for very long haul or some legacy integration. That would be my guess on that one. It's also got an interchangeable server board. So that is, once you've got the ASIC part of the architecture, the physical architecture, the actual x86 part that runs the operating system is actually changeable, interchangeable. So that if you don't like the current generation of x86 CPU or flash module or whatever that's in there and SSDs, you can actually replace it and upgrade it, which I think is an interesting thought, because until now, most top-of-rack switches have always been fully integrated on the motherboard. And we've got to the point now where the size of the ASIC chips and the size of the SerDes and the interface chips is now only about 6 inches deep. You don't actually need to have these switches, which are, you know, 800 deep to fit in the top of rack anymore. They're actually now very, very small. The only reason that a lot of these switches is actually still, you know, 40 centimeters deep is usually just because you can have low-cost airflow, and why not? If it's cheaper to do that, then why not do that? You get lots of air circulating, and it's easy to keep them cool. You don't have to spin the fans at a million miles an hour to suck air across those boards. So this idea of us increasing the CPU in the switch, I think, is the shift from switch runs dumb operating system that does nothing useful to switch as intelligent device that has stuff in it, which I think that's a real turnaround.
Well, it reminds me of Pluribus. Is that an unfair comparison?
I think Pluribus is still putting a server class, like a true server in there, like it's a Xeon. This is more like, you know, we've got a low-cost, what's the low-cost CPUs that Intel has just gone out of my head for no reason? But, you know, instead of a low-cost CPU with a couple of gigs of RAM, Pluribus is more like 64 gigs or 128 gigs of RAM and quad Xeons or dual Xeons in there.
Yeah, Pluribus truly is a server. I mean, the comparison here, Pluribus truly is a server platform with a switch built in, as opposed to this is a server. This is a switch, what Facebook's created here, that just has more power because you can do more interesting networky things. Yeah. Pluribus is a little bit different of an architecture and purpose.
Mm. Yeah. So I think that's, you know, it's sort of like that's hindsight into the future. You remember that I was doing some research around the Tomahawk 2 and the Tomahawk Broadcom's now releasing chipset iterations at a two-yearly cycle. So it's literally 2 years ago that the last generation of the Tomahawk came out. We had a TOC release or a point release about a year ago. So I think we're going to start to see the acceleration around the Tomahawk or the silicon, the switching ASICs, is going to continue. I don't think it's going to be like every year like Intel CPUs is, but I do think we're going to see a fairly continuous iteration, and the merchant silicon is going to improve dramatically into the future if this pace keeps up. So I'm hopeful for that, because I think merchant silicon is better for networking as a whole. I don't believe that. I still remain of the view that vendors making their own silicon doesn't add any value to what customers want or need.
Do you know what Broadcom's spin time is for an ASIC? If from inception and design to actual fab, is that 2 years, or is that still more like 4 or 5 years?
I think it comes in different zones. I think they used to have a chipset before the Tomahawk, and I think it took them 2 or 3 years to iterate. And I'm not an expert here, maybe somebody who's much closer to Broadcom, but I know that Broadcom has you covered by very strict NDAs and you're not allowed to talk about it, so probably we'll never hear anything. But I think that Broadcom's basically looking to respin to do major ink steps in the Tomahawk every 2 years. And then if there's a step, like a major advance, then that might come every 4 or 5 years. And that's roughly at least twice as fast, or half the time of what we've seen from other vendors. And it's about the one-third the time that Cisco takes to do the equivalent.
All right. Facebook taking advantage of that merchant silicon.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I do. I really think so. Not only are they doing the silicon, but they're also doing some really good stuff around the physicals. Mm-hmm. So it uses the open compute racking standards, and that means it supports the open rack version 2 bus bar. So that means if you want to run it from the bus, a DC power bus on the back of the open rack standard, you can do that. And it also uses QSFP28 DAC, which is, if you don't know what that is, that's fine. And it uses 55C CWDM4 optical transceivers. So those are the standards that they're chasing after. I think that's really interesting. Some of the physical design is very interesting. And then the final part is, of course, the software. So the blog post that Facebook put together talks extensively about how they're iterating on FBOSS, the Facebook operating system that runs on these switches, and specifically how they're continuing to enhance the BGP. Now, I know that most of you don't run BGP in your data center and probably never will, but that's the way Facebook is running there. So they're doing a lot of work around the Facebook FBOSS software to get that working. And it's interesting to see that they're talking about the software and not just the hardware in these pieces.
Although, touching back on the hardware for a second, the reason they're going open compute is because they can take a design to all the ODMs and say, here, we've got this open specification. You guys figure it out and then come back to us, and they can get a little bit of competitive advantage by having different folks building these designs for them. Plus, it's also open out to the community if folks want to take advantage of it.
Yeah, I'm hoping that as time goes by, we'll see more startups or, you know, existing vendors will start to iterate around FBOSS. I'm particularly, now that it seems to me like the OpenSwitch, do you remember the OpenSwitch project from the HP led and then handed over to the foundation? That appears to have lost momentum and perhaps lost support. Mm-hmm. You were at Dell this week, Ethan. Did you hear anything about Dell's OS X operating system, Open?
They didn't make any big announcements about OS X. In fact, kind of comically, it came up in a press analyst Q&A session with Michael Dell, and one of the folks in the room asked him about it, and he thought, do you mean Windows 10? And it was all a bit unsettling and awkward for a minute there, and then, oh, no, the network. Oh, and he kind of paused for a minute. Well, I got people for that. It was more or less his answer. So certainly at the very top, not really on their radar, which kind of makes sense considering the niche. But I did get an opportunity to chat with one of the folks inside the networking team and asked him about the status of things. And it's rolling right along, and we're going to hear some announcements about it, some things that I can't talk about yet because it's not official. But there are some announcements coming on about OS X, and it does seem to be getting strong support within OCP as the platform that you would run on an OCP switch and then stand up your layer 3 daemons of choice and whatever other network magic daemons you may choose to run on that open switch. OS X, we could see as the de facto standard. You know, we'll see.
Yeah, this hardware is certainly, you know, it may not be for everybody, and maybe you would want to go and buy Dell's hardware because, as I've said before, you know, if you've got a remote data center and you can't afford to hold stock, you should be able to, you know, if the product's cheap enough, you should be able to hold your own spares. But if you want somebody to carry one onto your premises and put it in the rack for you because for whatever reason, then vendors are going to give you that because they've got the money. You know, you're going to pay generously for that privilege in terms of maintenance contracts because somebody has to hold stock and labor forces and train them and everything. But I think increasingly, you know, these types of switches, it's just finding the operating. We know the hardware exists now. Just where's the operating system?
All right, we're going to talk a little bit more about Dell later, but we've got some stories about collaboration coming up, so let's move on to that.
Well, because collaboration matters.
not that. We just got to move this show along.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so first up, Cisco, they announced that they are acquiring a very small startup called WorkLife. WorkLife has raised $2.72 million in seed funding, so I'm guessing this was just couch cushion money for Cisco. They didn't disclose the terms of the acquisition, but probably not a big payout. What WorkLife does is they, and this sounds really sad, but they make software to make meetings better. And Cisco's going to fold this into their Spark platform.
To make meetings better. So do they, it's like a gun on a pivot that sits in the middle of the conference table and whichever person is talking, it's aimed at them. And as they're talking, the hammer slowly moves back. So if they talk too long, they die. That would make meetings better. So am I close?
I think you may have something there.
I think what we need to do is just iterate that more effectively into a team solution, which doesn't eliminate the problem, but just helps to move it forward. So I think it just needs to be paintballs.
Or like a cage of like angry killer bees, and the cage will slowly start to rise as you talk. You get three slides and then the door opens and it's bee time.
I mean, I can't imagine. So Cisco's continuing to double down on its collaboration strategy. It's trying to get people to adopt the Cisco Spark, and that is, of course, a nice add-on to their call center strategy and their video. You know, they're trying to integrate their IP telephony, their Jabber messaging, and the video conferencing platform that they bought, the Danberg stuff that they bought. And then they brought up Cisco Spark to compete with Slack. And then this is another value add. And maybe for a certain type of person who's not going to Azure for their email, this could be something that would help them to replace their email dependency. It seems to me, I know that there are a number of companies who are riding on the top of Slack providing these as well, and you can buy them as add-ons. So I'm not entirely sure that this is a home run for Cisco. They do still have to compete with Slack, which I think most people would tell you is far superior and in every dimension.
Well, sticking with that, Cisco's not the only one competing with Slack. Facebook recently launched something called Workplace by Facebook, which is also a corporate collaboration and looks pretty much exactly like Facebook, but just for work. So you can do things like chat with coworkers, create collaboration spaces, get a news feed of corporate announcements, share links, blah, blah, blah. It's priced at $1 or up to $3 per user per month. It's been being beta tested for a year and a half, and now it's available. Fortune called this product an email killer, but as we mentioned, it looks to me more like something they're going against Slack or Microsoft Yammer.
Well, are any of these products an email killer, I guess, is the question. And although I think we're Slack users, right, at Packet Pushers Interactive. Yes. And has it eliminated email? It certainly cut back on it substantially, but there's still things we need email for. So it's hard to categorize as an email killer, any of these products, but I just got to take a step back and go, really? Live in the Facebook interface all day, only doing it for work? That sounds dreadful to me. Yes, that has no appeal whatsoever as an end user.
Yeah, although apparently they've got they've got a pretty decent collection of corporations using that beta version. So we'll see if this gets some uptake. But I agree, it looks exactly like Facebook, and that just does not resonate with me as a work environment.
Interface aside, doesn't it seem like odd positioning to you? I mean, because to me, Facebook is very much a consumer-facing app. I don't think of it as a work-related app. I don't really want to mash up all of the different messages and articles and content and so on that I deal with into one interface. I'm happy to have separate places I go, separated topically. So I don't know. I'd be surprised if this really takes off. I mean, I'm sure they'll have some users, but
I think any form of these chat boards, whether it's Slack, Workplace, Facebook, Cisco's, any of these internal chat boards are new, and people who use them will suddenly discover that email is the worst way to communicate with people, right? Mm. And so any company that gets significant adoption of any of these chat platforms will give you quotes saying how awesome it was for their company. But it's not because the product is awesome, but it's because the way of working is quite actually transformational. My question is, I would like to evaluate the supplier as how committed are you to these products? So if I had to look at Slack, Slack exists to make the world's best communication platform in a chat message that works asynchronously. So what you're really replacing is the asynchronous nature of email with the asynchronous nature of chat in chat rooms. And that's what Slack does. And what Cisco's product, well, Cisco Spark, and what Facebook for Work is trying to do is say, we've got a bunch of other stuff, so we'll give you that for free too, right? Whatever, just have that. And you know what? We've got a whole bunch of other things in there, and our platform, it's like going to a supermarket and you can have one of everything. So Cisco's got video conferencing integrated and call center integration and blah, 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 blah. And none of the, neither Cisco or Facebook are actually committed to making these products a success. Slack exists. Its whole purpose, its reason d'etre, is so that they can perform the best communication. Facebook for Work is like, we developed this app internally, and you know what? It was kind of successful, so we can just make it available to put in a few months' work, and we'll make it available to everybody. And you know what? If nobody takes it up, we'll turn it off. It'll Google it, you know? So
sure.
I'm not sure that it's, you know, make all the hoo-ha you like. I don't think Facebook or Cisco are committed to these communication methods. They're just, we'll put them in because Slack's popular and see if the people like it.
I think there's something to that. I also think companies like Facebook, even though it's huge and giant and seems unstoppable, they have deep in their hearts this fear that the next big social media platform is going to come along and suddenly, you know, Facebook turns into MySpace. And so this may be a sort of a wedge or a bulwark against that happening by making Facebook so much a part of your life that it's at work and also it's your personal communication platform. It's, I think it's a way to try to sustain their growth and momentum. That saying, if it doesn't work out, I don't think they'd have a problem pulling the plug.
I agree with you that they are under fire because the younger generation doesn't use Facebook. So they can see down the road that their interactions are going to start dropping off over time. It's just going to happen.
And so their bosses will make them use Facebook?
Well, Facebook says the data that you do in the workplace is not integrated with your account. And they made the same promise with WhatsApp. And then look where that got you. So all of a sudden last week, I used WhatsApp to communicate with a couple of people. And all of a sudden, those contacts are appearing in my Facebook stream. I really don't trust Facebook. And I would think that if you made me work Facebook, I would seriously consider whether I'd work with you. Also, I just want to take you up on your point, Drew, about it being a strategy. I don't think this was a strategy. I think this was a lucky happenstance. Somebody developed it internally because they needed something like Slack. They developed one that runs on Facebook's platforms. It's an accident. It's not a deliberate strategy.
I think you're right that the development was an accident, but then they're seeing the adoption of collaboration platforms and thinking, hey, maybe we can turn this accident into a strategy.
Yeah. Like I said, there's a difference between being the pig and being the hen when you're putting the breakfast on the farmer's breakfast on the table. Slack's the pig and Facebook's just laying eggs. So who cares?
Okay. I'm not sure how to work that metaphor, though, because it's the pig that gets killed and eaten. So I don't know. Where
exactly.
You're
going. The pig's fully committed to the farmer's breakfast.
The pig ain't committed at all to my breakfast. The pig wants something to do with my breakfast.
Exactly. That's my point. When it comes to delivering the farmer's breakfast, the pig is all in. Right. Whereas the chicken's okay. Just like, yeah, it's just another day. Right. I can move on. I'll still be here after the pig farm.
Got it. All right. So let's move on. We're going to take a minute to talk to you about Viptela. And guys, you have an event coming up with them. Greg, you want to give us some details?
Yes. Well, Viptela and the Software Defined WAN. We know that our Software Defined WAN is pretty big. We're talking to I've seen some various bits of research suggesting it's going to be a $2 billion market in 2017, which is like, hoorah, let's go and chase us down some SD-WAN. And I literally, not just a few minutes ago, got off the phone from a client who was asking me to give them some advice. And basically, it was they need an SD-WAN. And it really is just quite a change from the way that your routed backplanes work. And it gets you free of the vendors. So what Viptela have done has assembled three customers who have actually deployed their product in a cloud-centric way. So that is, they're using the WAN in a way to replace their cloud access. They're cloud-centric, so we're going to be talking about how they connect and what is it about the software-defined WAN that they wanted to do. It's going to be on Monday, October 24th. That's just a few days' time. We're recording this on Friday the 21st. I'm flying out there, me and Ethan, on the Sunday, so we'll be there. It's going to be held at the Loft Flatiron, whatever that is, in Manhattan at 6:30 p.m. So maybe you're down there for the ONU conference. Maybe you're just in New York for whatever. But if you go over to viptela.com to get some details and you can register to sign up, we'd love to see you. There's going to be some drinks and food there as courtesy of Viptela. And we'll be recording a live podcast on the SD-WAN with some pretty cool people who are going to tell us about their real life stories of deploying SD-WAN and have some fun at the same time.
All right. You can find that link at packetpushers.net or go to viptela.com and find the link. Please do register and we hope to see you there. Okay, some news from VMware. Last week, we had talked about VMware and AWS teaming up to run a hybrid cloud. VMware also announced the official availability of the vSphere Integrated Container, or VIC, which lets companies run Docker containers inside a VMware virtual machine.
Yeah, they were pushing this at VMworld, the VMware Integrated Containers, and this is the idea that you can optimize the container format to run on the ESX hypervisor. And then now the question is, whose API are you going to use to run containers? Remember, we talked a couple of weeks ago about VIO, which is VMware's integrated OpenStack. So in this direction, you've now got the capability to run that on the platform. And so, yeah, good to see it actually shipping. It's not just one of these products that, you know, big announcement, lots of smell, and then everybody goes like, well, who did it? Who smelt it? Delta? And then we all walk away laughing. It's actually something.
Well, they've been trialing it for a while. It's now officially available. And the idea here is developers get to use Docker, but the operations team can use the containerized apps using techniques and tools they're accustomed to, that whole VMware infrastructure. So I think VMware is definitely trying to serve these two consistencies here, constituencies.
Yeah. So this was, you know, VMware Las Vegas. We saw all about it. And there are significant challenges around how you do things like containers. The things that people don't know is like training is a problem. Performance is a problem. You can't accurately predict the performance of containers today, and managing containers. So the way that you manage containers today is you turn them off and delete them. You don't patch them or fix them. You reboot the image. And I think VMware's made a bunch of enhancements in there to say, we've got a way to use containers on top of vSphere and make it more efficient. So if you've got vSphere, it keeps you not nice and tightly integrated into that environment. And of course, if you're using other tools like vSAN and NSX, you get to reuse all of those expensive licenses that you bought and maximize your investment.
Maximize.
We're still relevant. We matter. We matter. Seriously, we do containers now. I'm just sitting here listening to this going, I get this. I understand where it fits and who it's going to be interesting to. And the other half of me goes, this is the dumbest thing I have ever heard of. Why would you ever do this? You don't need virtual machines if you have a proper container management system, et cetera. But it really speaks to the immaturity of the container orchestration ecosystem and the ability of folks to take advantage of that sort of world right now because they're so entrenched in VMware. You really need this transitional state of things to get you from point A to point B. But I do see it that way. I see it as transitional.
I think the point here isn't the ESX. I think it's the NSX and the vSAN. When you're running Docker, you sort of assume that your storage is somewhere. It's just like here, if you're in the public cloud, and your network has to be just there. So if you're already running NSX and you're running vSAN as well as your, you know, vCenter, it makes sense to find a way to run containers integrated in your vCenter platform to me anyway.
There is some discussion on an article in the NewStack. We'll have a link to it that talks about how what VMware is doing is they're taking the networking and the storage functions away from the Docker container and letting VMware take care of it because of exactly those reasons. It's already integrated into vSAN, into NSX, all those other things that you've set up.
That's right. So the idea is you just go into the cloud and you click it and your Docker containers mysteriously appear.
Yes.
That's the way private clouds have to look. And the only way to do that is if you've got some sort of storage, some sort of network, and some sort of, you know, access to compute. Well, guess what? That in Amazon's AWS, that's S3 storage. It's their integrated networking. It's their EC2 VMs. And guess what this is? It's exactly the same thing. So there is a purpose for it, but at the same time, you can just as equally run Docker on bare metal and then just abstract away to some direct storage, block storage array using iSCSI or whatever. It's really just a question of how do you operationalize it.
And well, I agree with Ethan that it is an indication that there is an immaturity around that whole operationalization and orchestration of the container world because it is so new. And so, you know, VMware is seeing an opportunity to step in and keep themselves relevant.
You think?
I do.
Like the container, the immature. Well, they're only invented 2 years ago. You know. So let's just, because I mentioned VMware and AWS, it's just one more thing that I think I would like to point out is a lot of people were saying in the last week, you know, that we're talking about building VMware software-defined data centers in the AWS infrastructure is that VMware is giving it away to AWS. AWS is winning. I would just like to point out that it's a fair bet that EMC execs or VMware execs have actually thought of that, right? What are we giving away to AWS? I think the unanswered question that people aren't asking and nor is it being answered is, what is VMware going to do to make money from AWS? So is there, you know, why would they take this risk of putting their customers into AWS and losing them to AWS services unless the reverse path exists? And what is it that VMware saw they could get from that? I'm not sure that I actually understand that yet. And I don't see anybody asking that question or anybody giving me answers.
Well, I'm going to venture a couple things One is that VMware didn't really have a choice. Customers were going there already. So VMware is hoping to make it easier for customers to take VMware with them into AWS. Second, if the AWS instantiation is really as simple as they make it sound, then every time you spin up a VMware hypervisor in AWS, VMware is getting that license revenue. So I think it helps reduce some of that friction and some money comes back to VMware there.
Well, like I said last week, I'm still convinced this is a kick in the teeth for the incumbent infrastructure vendors who aren't, you know, they haven't jumped on a VxRail, which is a very quick way to deploy a software-defined data center. They haven't simplified their infrastructure so it's easy to consume. We've seen some hyperconvergent coming out, but not really, you know, solving those problems. And a lot of the hyperconverged vendors aren't using vSAN or NSX. They're cut their own sort of solutions. I'm just not 100% sure, you know, is VMware betting that people might be exiting AWS? And this gives them a way to get back onto VMware if they move away from EC2 instances? As ES?
I think it's a way to build out hybrid cloud. That's what it is. That it's an easy way to stick with the operations you're familiar with a vendor that you know, processes, terminology, software that you're familiar with. And then now you've got an easy migration path into hybrid cloud. If you've been trying to do them separately inside my data center on premises, I've got VMware and my public cloud stuff is AWS, which is very different and feels odd, and I need different expertise. Now I don't have that problem, and they just made VMware sticky and gave people this very comfortable way to do hybrid cloud. So, and in addition to the cost management elements that they've added to the product set, to me it's just how do we stay relevant for the long term. And people want hybrid cloud, so let's give them a way to get there and have VMware branded all over everything. So, yeah. Drew, I believe that all underscores the two points you made.
Okay, I'll take that, but I'm still not convinced we understand the reverse direction. You know, where's the revenue win for VMware? Does it all go towards AWS, or is it, you know, is it a rearguard action? I don't think so. I think there's a reverse direction that we're not seeing.
Well, how do you think it's different just because the infrastructure is now AWS instead of Metal? How do you think the revenue stream is different for VMware?
They do instantiate a software-defined data center on bare metal. That was clear in the blog post. So it's not like you're running on an EC2 KVM hypervisor. You're still running on ESX instances inside of Amazon Cloud, right? So the question is that, you know, does the revenue that they lose to AWS as customers move to serverless or, you know, object storage in S3 or, you know, whatever it is, whatever services they use, is that as a net revenue gain for VMware, or is there something else that they're going to build on top of this? That's, you know, they've got the vCloud Air network and the vCloud Air data centers, none of which have been hugely successful. They don't seem to have set the world on fire, and they are software-defined data centers that you can just go and click a button and get access to. So what makes this one better?
It's relationship maintenance. It's not losing the customer outright.
Yeah.
It isn't going to be a huge – it isn't going to be the ideal situation for them with all the revenues they wish they had. But it does prevent that customer from completely disappearing because this is an easier path to trod.
In some ways, I feel like, you know, we'll talk about Intel a little bit later in their quarterly results. But just like Intel continues to make chips for PCs, even though the PC market is declining, it's because they can still – get money out of it. So this is like for VMware going into AWS, yes, it's sort of helping that transition into a more cloud-centric environment, but there's a very, very long and profitable tail for them to ride while this happens. And so they're keeping that customer close. They're keeping them wrapped up in the nice VMware blanket. Same thing with the container store we just talked about. It's about there's a transition, and it may not be great for VMware in the long run, but as they figure that out, in the meantime, they've got a nice story for customers and they keep them close.
I'm not convinced.
Good. We can keep arguing about it in a different episode, but we have to move on now.
Yes.
DDoS. DDoS is the next topic. And A10 Networks, Greg, you found a slideshow about A10 releasing a gigantic DDoS protection platform called Thunder.
Thunder, the multi-vector DDoS disruption with expanded Thunder TPS. You know, you just want to have like a voiceover guy. This is a new appliance from A10 Networks. A single appliance can do over 300 gigabits per second of bandwidth protection in a single box. And it does this, seriously, by using 14 Xeons. Each one has 18 cores. And then also on the motherboard is an Intel SPE module, which runs a full-on FPGA. and it has 4x100 gig Ethernet interfaces in addition to 4 power supplies.
Wow.
So, I was just going to say, you must have to have your own power plant to power this monster. What a beast.
It's big. But I mean, you're talking about, I'm thinking about how much power you want to consume to run that. And I also just want to point out that this is going to be great for anybody who's got 300 gigabits per second of bandwidth. You should run right out and have one of those. I don't. I'm not too sure how many people have 300 gigabits of data center in their enterprise data center. So I don't think so. But if you're a carrier or a service provider, or maybe you're running an entire colo and you need to put a DDoS engine in front, and you also then want to double down on that DDoS engine to do a range of other features, this is going to be one of the biggest devices. It actually is, I think, several tens of gigabits bigger than the current biggest boxes from Imperva and others. So quite a win for A10, I think.
They've got a really interesting one of the slides that shows one A10 box stacked up against like 8 or 9 of their competitor boxes. And I'm not sure about the truth of it, but it's a very arresting visual. So we'll have the link to the slideshow. Go check it out.
That's right. You can cluster them up. You can cluster 6 of them together to do 2.4 terabits per second and some phenomenal packets per second as well. It's a very large thing. So well done to A10, because and the thing to remember about A10 that I actually like more than anything else is, even though they're using hardware acceleration here, they are fundamentally a software company. They have always been about their software, and they just happen to be using the hardware to accelerate the software, which is probably why they're actually finally able to stretch out and deliver these features. So a company that recognized software very early making headway seems to be a good narrative to have.
Well, speaking of DDoS, this morning that we're recording the show on a Friday, the infrastructure provider Dyn is reporting a significant denial of service attack. It's affecting customers on the U.S. East Coast. Sites like the New York Times, the Boston Globe, Reddit, they've all had delays and outages. Time Magazine posted a cool image from Level 3 showing a heat map of the outage, and it's essentially a giant angry red cloud that stretches from New England all the way down to Virginia and the Carolinas.
Good Lord, I drove right by Dyn headquarters on my way home from the airport last night. I thought I felt a disturbance in the forest.
This has been happening a lot lately. We saw a big announcement a couple of weeks ago on Level 3's backbone and a couple of others. Comcast was struggling as well. And so this is happening more and more often. And, of course, I think about 4 or 5 weeks ago, Bruce Schneier published an article about there's a number of companies. There seems to be some sort of actor named for an unknown threat or unspecified threat who is constantly probing the internet to see how much it would take to take down certain parts of the internet infrastructure. And the reverse side of, you know, what companies like sponsors of our off packet pushes like Thousand Eyes and others who are able to map out the internet and to monitor and probe it, is that this also puts in place large scale actors, state actors to start mapping the internet and start thinking about them as targeting them for attacks. So this is, you know, the cyber threats.
You know, the company 128 Technologies, who we've been briefed by, and their mantra is the internet is broken, you know, which I always felt was a little bit of a stretch. This is the first time just thinking about this that I'm starting to get their point of view here, why they're trying to push that message, because the internet was designed to be open, and therefore there is no authentication of streams or anything. It's a free-for-all, and so you can have state actors, as you said, Greg, or, you know, malicious hacker groups, or, you know, the Russian mafia, or fill in the blank with whatever evil character you want that can figure out how to find a vulnerable point on the internet and do a DDoS attack and drive the need for the A10 box that we were talking about, et cetera. Because if you go, how would I fix this problem? You can't fix this problem fundamentally. There is no way to, quote unquote, fix it. You can mitigate it. You can fight it. You can hope it goes away. But you can't actually fix it without changing the underlying principles of how the internet works, which makes me wonder, you know, 128 Tech, their box and what they do is pretty hard to imagine being implemented or rolled out globally on an internet scale to fix a lot of problems. But it does speak to, you know, what they're doing with authentication of
it's a bit like you can't protect a highway. You can't protect the highway from traffic jams because you can't control people who use the highway, right? Not a new problem. You know, and you can't stop people from putting bombs on highways, even as civil society. So, but that's the only difference is a case of access. That it is true that anybody can access the internet from anywhere in the world, and that changes the nature of the threat.
All right. Quick sponsor break sponsors ThousandEyes. As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. That's a huge problem when you're running critical apps, websites, and services, and that's where ThousandEyes comes in. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. That's your corporate network, the internet, your cloud service providers, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. And with these vantage points, you get the most complete understanding of your network topology, dependencies, and behavior. So with ThousandEyes, you can do things like piece together multiple layers of network insight from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance, precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems such as device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, hijacks, root leaks, and more. You can share data and insights with your vendors and customers to resolve problems. And there's a special offer for our Packet Pushers listeners. You can sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/PacketPushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, it's network intelligence you can see. All right, back to the show. Dell EMC World took place last week. It was the first customer conference since the close of the merger. But Ethan, you were there. It seems like not a lot of hard news came out. It was more sort of about here we are, our new organization. What were your takeaways?
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of product news at all. Branding was part of it. And one of the recurring themes coming from Michael Dell and the other execs was, hey, we are one company now. And they were really blunt about that and aggressive in making sure people got that point, that Dell and EMC are one company. So that was a thing that did include a rebranding effort where you see Dell EMC logos on the front of things that may have said Dell or EMC in the past. And then there was a lot of trumpeting of, hey, we've got Dell hardware sitting behind products that we're familiar with, like VxRack and VxRail, and several other products were mentioned that, hey, there's now Dell servers under there, under the hood, making up that product. There wasn't any particular news. I mean, there were some minor product announcements here and there. And of course, all the different BUs had their little bits to say. Lots going on within the EMC world, lots going on within the Dell world. But then nothing exciting, just a lot of little things that were mentioned if you got to talk to any of the product line managers and so on. They are beginning to go through the redundancy elimination part. There are going to be some layoffs coming up that we're going to be hearing about. They didn't make a big deal about that, but you kind of, you know, if you ask the right questions, talk to the right people, you found out that that was already underway, being discussed and evaluated as the different groups align. There's already motion of some reorganization, how they're handling certain departments, as you would expect. Nothing unusual here when you got two companies joining together. There was a lot of positioning of, you know, who are we now, especially coming from Michael Dell himself, making the point that as from their perspective, the executive perspective, as you look down the road of where IT is heading, Dell is the provider that is best positioned to meet the needs of future IT, whatever that might be, whether you're enterprise or whether you're a cloud provider, et cetera. And many slides that they shared had, we're number one in this category, that category, and the other category. I have rarely seen so much chest thumping in a presentation like that. All these different categories where they were quote unquote number one. They even, Michael Dell, his pet PC category, he was even talking about how they have strengths there, and that's hard, far from a dying business. And no, the tablet's not going to take over things, and so on. They did have an IoT message that I wrote a bit about on packetpushers.net. I think it's very hopeful, but they almost made it sound like IoT is the next big thing and we're going to ride this wave into the next, 5 or 10 years of IoT driving the need for compute power, where all this sensor data that all these enterprises are going to have, all these sensors that are out there, the data that must be processed are going to drive a need for infrastructure processing power, both locally for things that need to be real time and then up in the cloud for things that don't have to be real time. And we don't care if it's the enterprise buying this compute from us or if it's the cloud providers. We can supply to both, no problem. Which kind of was a little odd. I talked to a bunch of other analysts and press folks, and everyone was kind of going, yeah, but does it make sense that IoT is going to drive that much data for everybody? And of course, it really doesn't in the long term.
Yeah, well, the only market that's going to grow for Dell, like storage, enterprise storage, enterprise IT shrinking is the cloud. Dell's got a business unit supplying hardware to the cloud, but increasingly, Facebook, Amazon, Google are making their own servers. So that's not necessarily as much growth as they need. So the only growth market really that you can reliably predict right now is IoT. So it's not like it's genius to pick that one, don't you think?
It's not genius to pick that one, but it's not nearly as bright of a storyline as they wish it was, I think, is my point.
I think increasingly what we're seeing is it's not so much the companies or the strategies that we're seeing playing out. I think right now we're watching funding models. So Cisco is a shareholder-driven company that loves to pay its executives vast sums of money in terms of share options for companies. And that's one business model. And Cisco's saying, we're going to land and expand. We're going to take our place inside the enterprise and grow horizontally. We've seen Dell say, no, we're going to go into private ownership. That's going to allow us to do big things. And one of the big things that we're doing is we're going to get bigger at scale so that we can take over control of more market share. And there's another one, which is HPE, still market listed, but it intensively has to fight with hedge funds for survival who are trying to, you know, drive the share price one way or the other. And HPE has decided to shrink it so it can get more control over its destiny. And I think these three different business models, and we could extrapolate this out to, you know, IBM and any other IT company, Huawei and ZTE have very different strategies again. And what we're actually seeing isn't actually a product strategy or a technology strategy between these companies. It's literally this is our business strategy. This is our funding model. This is how our profits have to look. And that's increasingly driving these companies forward. It's not about technology or product anymore or customer service or customer values. It's literally about what is the business behind these companies. And that's going to be ascendant for the next 5 years, I think.
A question I got for you, Greg, regarding Dell's messaging of we'll supply to the enterprise and we can supply to web scale, hyperscale as well. Does that ring true to you, particularly the part about the web and hyperscale? Are they buying from Dell?
I think some of them are. And I know that, for example, the rumor mill would say that eBay, PayPal is buying from Dell because Dell makes it easier for them. But I doubt that Facebook, Amazon is buying from Dell. Or maybe they do for some data centers, but not for others, because these people tend to buy a data center at a time. And then when the data center's dead, they empty it out and refresh the entire data center at a time. And I think that Dell is probably feeding a lot of the bigger companies or the bigger enterprise companies who are building clouds, like substantial clouds, you know, 50,000 to 80,000 servers in a data center, and they've got three or four of them. But whether they're supplying companies like Salesforce et al., I doubt it. I think that those companies are making increasingly skilling up and buying directly from source so that they have full control over the build process. Like, look at what LinkedIn's doing with their Open 19 rack platform or building their own switches, because that makes sense for them. So no, I don't think that claim is going to hold a lot of water. There's truth to it, just not a lot of truth.
That's kind of my take too, that the bigger the shops, the more likely that they're going to be insourcing the talent and expertise they need to be able to drive a white box solution. And they'll be going cheap commodity hardware as much as possible and anything branded, even Dell, which I think would tend to be the lower price leader in that space, would not be able to compete there, would be my assumption. So it'd be interesting.
Well, keep in mind, as the enterprise shrinks, Dell, IBM, Cisco, their manufacturing divisions shrink too. And those people then go out onto the open market. And it's very easy at a sheer practical resourcing level to go and hire people who are well experienced at building servers, because they're out there looking for jobs, right? So it's not like they can't do it themselves if they didn't want to. It's not like eBay couldn't go and build a server build team and start designing their own servers if they didn't want to. They can just go and hire them. They're not hard to find.
But long story short, if you're an enterprise that's a Dell EMC customer, I mean, they've still got all the products there. They are there for you. They are truly beginning to integrate products. They were big on the VxRail and rack products with various announcements around capacity there. They mentioned a VxRail 3U form factor box that can handle, I forget how many VMs, et cetera, but it was under $50,000, as they said, was the list price of this thing. And for the vast majority of mid-range customers, that box, you could run your whole data center on it, was how they were positioning it. So it was pretty interesting, and Dell certainly got a lot going on in that space. Sorry, Dell EMC. They were
Dell EMC.
One company now.
So, Ethan, I want to ask you, you said they were very much thundering this message, we are one company now. I'm curious, how much do you think this was for public, for potential customers, and how much was also aimed at their own internal employees? Because when you try to merge two companies with different cultures, that can be really hard.
It's both, Drew, is my take. So, yes, it was important for public and for customers. Dell and EMC both with huge and not necessarily the same customer base, but getting that message across to them was a big deal. But then also getting across internally, you're talking about a lot of different companies and cultures, and some of the Dell or EMC folks were telling me about, or VCE folks or VMware folks were telling me about some of the changes that have already gone on internally because of this. And there didn't seem to be resentment. It was more of, you know, yep, okay, well, this is changing and this is the way this is. And they were some subtle things, some larger things, some branding things, some things like, I'm a product line manager with this product set, and this product used to be my enemy, my target, the thing I would go after. Now it's mine. I have to add it to my portfolio and make it work with all this other stuff I already manage. So there's a lot of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I do feel it was both, because there was certainly a shakeup, a large number of employees affected, with a huge number of technology products kind of coming together now, as well as the public, so that the public understands this is more than an acquisition and it's a hands-off, we're letting EMC do their thing, et cetera, that there really was a merger there. And I think the whole look at this product that used to be whatever hardware underneath, that is now running Dell hardware underneath. They were really hammering that point home and bragging about how quickly they did the integration. You know, when this happened, it was 7 or 10 weeks or something, some fairly short amount of time to get the integration done. Also indicating it was a priority for us internally. And hey, customer, look how much emphasis we placed on making this happen.
Okay. I just, that's all great, but that doesn't mean anything for customers. Customers don't have, we're still seeing shrinking server sales, shrinking desktop sales. That sounds much more like buggy whips than it does, Model T Fords in the classic, disruption sort of a thing. That I still don't see how we're going to pitch Dell as the next 20-year company just because it got bigger. Or is it just a very big company that'll take longer to die unless it finds the next revenue stream?
Well, I'm going to say you had mentioned, I think it's a good insight, that we're not just looking at technology competition, we're looking at business model competition. And by going private, Dell is staking out a model to say, we can run a business where we can exist on thin margins, maybe flat or slow growth, that a company like Cisco or HP is going to get hammered on by public markets if they're not showing bigger, stronger, faster growth.
And that's an awful thin line to bet a business on, $1 billion business on.
You got to roll the dice, though. All right, let's wrap up with a couple of stories about some quarterly earnings. One is from Intel. They reported their Q3 2016 financial results. They had, frankly, a whopping quarter, revenue of $15.8 billion, up nearly 10% versus last year. They have reported a net income of $3.9 billion. However, despite the positive report, Intel stocks fell around 5% in after-hours trading. There's an article in Motley Fool saying that because Intel's Q4 forecast was slightly lower than Wall Street was anticipating, the stock got hammered.
In other words, they told Wall Street it was going to be 10% better. The stock ran up to the 10% and it only came in a bit less. And so, oh dear, bad news all around. It's important to remember that a year ago, Intel was actually in substantial trouble. And the CEO, I think, or there was various hari-kuris committed at executive levels and some changes. So for them to turn it around isn't too bad, considering that they weren't getting much a year ago.
Yeah, it seems like what investors are looking for is growth from the data center group, so selling processors to the enterprise, to cloud, high-performance computing, that kind of thing. That's where they're seeing the growth is supposed to be coming from, and Intel's forecasting there is not what Wall Street quite wants to see. It's not where it is yet. So,
yeah, I think there's been a substantial pause in clouds. I think the IDG predicted the first 2 quarters of this year was quite slow for server sales, but it'll pick up at the end of this year as the number of data center refreshes pick up in the cloud providers. So perhaps Intel was hoping that the orders would come into this quarter rather than next quarter, and maybe got a bit caught out there. And of course, you never know what the cloud, if you're buying 80, 160, 240,000 servers at a time, that's an awful lot of CPUs. If that delays just by one quarter, that whacks out your results.
Sure it does.
It's going to hurt. I'm pretty sure if Apple announces new MacBook Pros, that's gonna set the Intel ship right.
Yeah.
All by itself.
I don't know about that. I'm not too sure. I mean, I don't think there's actually that many people buying MacBook Pros or Mac Pro servers.
Oh, I'm just being silly, but yeah.
I know you are, but there is an announcement next week. theoretically, new MacBooks will be announced. So it'll be interesting to see that, because I'm tossing up what to do with my mobile strategy. I don't know about you, Mr. Bates.
Tossing it up, yep. Do I replace the battery in this MacBook that's so old now it's starting to crash unexpectedly when the power gets low, or just buy a new one? Not sure.
Yes.
All right, our last story for the day, IBM, they reported their 18th straight quarter of declining revenue. They brought in $19.23 billion for the quarter, which is down 0.3% compared to last year. They also reported a net profit of $2.9 billion, down 4%. Wah, wah, wah.
Not unexpected, though, right? The share price didn't go any which way, because that's basically what they've told. Well, that must be a real kick in the teeth for the executives at IBM, who were very aggressively pursuing a 20% share dividend growth and chased after it for year after year and literally killed internal business units, used all sorts of financial magic and internal brutality to drive towards that number. And now they're paying the price. 18 straight quarters of decline after, you know, sacrificing everything on a pointless financial goal just to feed the share markets to get to a certain thing. They're still exporting some of their finest talent and their knowledge and their people to India in vast numbers. You've seen the press, you know, IBM is taking outsourcing contracts and then transferring them offshore, which is not making them popular because those outsourcing contracts never work. I just can't see how IBM comes out of this well. You know, professional services is not the future. We saw that announcement recently by Gartner saying, stop outsourcing, one, and two, start building up your internal skills. You need to know how to operate this stuff to get an ROI off it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, the company, one bright spot, they're pointing to a rise in what they call their strategic imperatives. That includes their cloud business. And according to their results, cloud revenue is up $3.4 billion in the quarter, which is a 44% year-over-year growth. So IBM trying to pluck some brightness out of this otherwise kind of gloomy report.
Sure. It's not getting as bad as it was.
That's the headline. Not as bad as it was.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
If you want to find more, I'll be publishing blog posts on packetpushers.net. I'm on the Twitters. It's at Ethereal Mind. And you can also find me on LinkedIn and Facebook. I have a Facebook page. If you're interested in following me there, just search up for Greg Farrow Ethereal Mind. And that's my Facebook page. Don't follow me personally. That's for personal things.
All right. Ethan, how about you?
At EC Banks on Twitter, and packetpushers.net is where all of my network and enterprise IT-related posts are going these days. And I, too, am on LinkedIn, but, you know, you hunt hard. You're not going to find me on Facebook. Sorry. Maybe someday, but this is not that day.
All right, I'm Drew Conry-Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsors, Viptela, and the live event with the Packet Pushers on Monday the 24th. And thank you for Thousand Eyes. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, even though Ethan isn't there. Leave a recommendation on iTunes. Share a link with your colleagues. And please do check out our newsletters. That's Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find links to signing up at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.